Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army, has seen living and dead extraterrestrials himself in his official duties on an Army team that retrieved crashed ET crafts. He has been given access to black ops bases and secret access projects. On February 26, 1942, commonly called the Battle of Los Angeles, our team found that there were some 15 to 20 unidentified craft flying over Los Angeles. We immediately responded by trying to shoot these objects down. The 37th Coastal Artillery Group expended 1,430 rounds. We set out to try to find out if there was some hidden base belonging to the Axis from where these planes could come, some commercial airport where they could have had these aircraft housed. None of this bore out. Every search effort we made turned out to be fruitless. At the same time in the Pacific, they were experiencing the same phenomena, the so-called Foo Fighters. General MacArthur directed his intelligence people to find out what was going on. I have reason to believe that in 1943 MacArthur found out that, in fact, we had things not of this Earth and visitors from some other planet visiting our planet that were actually observing the event we called the Second World War. One of the problems that MacArthur had was that, should this be the case, and should they prove to be hostile, we knew very little about them and we had very little means to defend ourselves. MacArthur organized what was called the Interplanetary Phenomena Research Unit. It would later be taken over by General Marshall. And it continued all the way through to present day. Names have been changed and records still haven't surfaced. The Army tries to state that it was not an official organization effort to investigate UFOs. But it was organized by a general, it bore fruit, it came to conclusions that were not popular, that is, interplanetary spacecraft. And they continued to do exactly what they do today, and that is to be part of a multi-intelligence operation in the recovery of objects of unknown origin, particularly those that are of non-earthly origin. Their purpose is to assess that information, get raw field intelligence data, and process that data into some type of useful intelligence product to disseminate to the field to those people who have a need to know and those people that are, shall we say, the keepers of that information. One of MacArthur's Air Force generals told him what we have is something not of this Earth. I would suggest that by this time, even the Germans had uncovered evidence that we were being visited and had some type of physical evidence. MacArthur definitely had physical evidence. From the documentation I saw while working this issue in the Army, I was not able to ascertain exactly what that physical evidence consisted of, only that it was there. Quotation, I would do it, parenthesis, study UFOs, but before agreeing to do it, we must insist upon full access to discs recovered. For instance, in the LA case, the Army grabbed it and would not let us have it for cursory examination. J. Edgar Hoover. Letter to Clyde Tilson, July 15, 1947. UFO Secret File Roswell. Documents. FBI document from Guy Hotel, Field Agent. March 22, 1950. Testimonials, Master Sergeant Dan Morris, NRO Operative, Cosmic Clearance. Richard Doty, Special Agent with Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Colonel Philip S. Corso, Senior Astronaut Gordon Cooper. AH Anonymous, Boeing Aircraft. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. UFO sightings increased after A-bombs were dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and a great deal of the new interstellar traffic was focused on New Mexico. Why New Mexico? The first nukes were created in Los Alamos and were tested in Alamogordo and White Sands, New Mexico. And then there was Roswell. Roswell will always be associated with the alleged UFO crashes reported in late June of 1947. At the time of these events, the Roswell Army Air Force Base had been the home of the 509th Bomber Squadron. The only wing in the world equipped with atomic weapons. The nuclear genie had been released from its bottle and it quickly became apparent to the military and civilian personnel working at these nuclear processing facilities, atomic bomb manufacturing plants, airfields and testing grounds that our ET visitors were very concerned with what we were doing. As one British intelligence official said, when we started detonating those atomic weapons and later hydrogen bombs, it was like we kicked over a hornet's nest. We now had the ability to destroy the entire planet, and the adults in the neighborhood were concerned. Despite government and military cover-ups, there remains an abundance of eyewitnesses and documented evidence supporting the fact that the events in Roswell did actually occur, including an FBI memorandum from a field agent addressed to the director of the FBI regarding the three so-called flying saucers recovered in New Mexico. This document, provided below, claims the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it is believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. I can assure you that a civilization capable of interstellar travel can handle a radar signal. The weapon activated at Roswell's base was most likely a scalar or longitudinal wave. A longitudinal wave is not limited to the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, it actually travels at multiples of the speed of light. The technology had been experimented with for decades in classified projects, and by 1947, most people are amazed when they hear this, we were more than capable of producing an effective electromagnetic weapon from these systems. On June 24, 1947, a UFO sighting made the international news. 8 nights later, three extraterrestrial vehicles began buzzing Roswell Air Force Base, prompting the military to activate what was most likely a scalar wave device. The UFOs crashed. Two were located immediately, the third several years later. Document 1, FBI Memorandum, retyped. Office Memorandum, United States Government 2, Director, FBI. Date, March 22, 1950. From Guy Hotel, SAC, Washington. Subject, Flying Saucers Information Concerning. The following information was furnished to SAC. An investigator for the Air Force stated that three so-called flying saucers had been recovered in New Mexico. They were described as being circular in shape with raised centers, approximately 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of a very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots. According to Mr. X, informant, the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it is believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. Document 2, FBI Memorandum. Testimonial. Dan Morris is a retired Air Force career master sergeant who was involved in the extraterrestrial projects for many years. After leaving the Air Force, he was recruited into the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Organization, or NRO, during which time he worked specifically on extraterrestrial connected operations. He had a cosmic top secret clearance, 38 levels above top secret, which, he states, no US president, to his knowledge, has ever held. What happened, parenthesis, at Roswell, was that we found out that high-powered radar would interfere with their, parenthesis, UFOs, stability, because we could watch the amplifiers and stabilizers come down when they were low and slow. Radar affected the UFOs when they were low and slow. We already knew that, we knew it before 1947, before they came down. Where was most of our radar? White Sands, and down at Roswell. Who was stationed at Roswell? The only nuclear bomb squadron in the world. So they were interested, and we had a lot of radar there, because we were going to protect as much as we could. Well, we focused several big, powerful radars on them, and it caused two of them to run together. One of them was the one that went down and landed on the ranch. The other was the one that went down into the bank, and it had two aliens on it, parenthesis, they were lying outside when we got there. One of them was wounded or hurt, and the other was alive then, but before we could get him anywhere, he had already passed on. But the other ET from the other crash. We kept at Los Alamos over here for about 3 years. He got sick. We sent signals out on every frequency range we could and everything, that he was sick, that we didn't do it, that they could come and get him if they wanted to. But he died before they got here. They came and got his body, and that's when they went to Washington and had that formation over Washington, so they retrieved his body. Testimonial. Richard Doty was a special agent for counterintelligence for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI. For over 8 years, he was specifically tasked with the UFO/extraterrestrial issue at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, and also at Nellis Air Force Base, the so-called Area 51, and at other locations. The Roswell crash didn't actually happen at Roswell, it happened southwest of Corona, New Mexico. The second crash site was discovered in Horse Mesa west of Magdalena, New Mexico. The Roswell crash site was located in June of 1947. The second crash in Magdalena wasn't located until about 1949. As part of my briefing, we were shown a 16mm movie of the, parenthesis, Roswell, recovery. Obviously, the movie was classified. The film showed military personnel recovering ET bodies at the site, as well as the craft. And one live extraterrestrial was found at the site. We were told the surviving ET went to Kirtland Air Force Base and then on to Los Alamos for some time. The movie didn't fully explain exactly what happened to that extraterrestrial, although it did explain that it died, I believe in 1952. The bodies of the, parenthesis, deceased, extraterrestrials were placed in a deep freeze and sent to Wright-Patterson Field in Dayton, Ohio. The craft was more or less an oval or egg-shaped craft. It wasn't saucer-shaped. The creatures were about 4 feet, parenthesis, tall. Some of the creatures were mangled, were heavily injured and their bodies were torn apart. But two of the bodies were pretty much intact, and if there was an autopsy, they didn't discuss that. They didn't appear to have any ears. They had an indentation for a nose, very big eyes. They had a really tight-fitting suit which almost looked like they were nude. Their hands had no thumbs, just 4 fingers with suction devices on the tips. And one of them had a head apparatus on it. Maybe a helmet or some kind of earphone or communication device. A number of different objects were found in the craft, including a rectangular piece of what they first assumed was plexiglass, which they kept for years before they figured out it was the energy device for the craft. They also showed us the recovery of the craft in 1949 in Horse Mesa. That craft crashed at the same time the 1947 craft crashed, but because of the remoteness of that location, it wasn't located until a rancher found it on his property 2 years later. By that time, the bodies had decayed, but the craft was the same type that was found near Corona, NM. In regard to a timeline and the location of these crash sites, nobody has it right. One of the frustrating things for the people who have been briefed into this program is that there is not much out there that's factual. The UFO community misinforms itself. 90% of the people who write these Roswell books have never been in the military, worked for the intelligence community, or held a security clearance, and they're just relying on second, third and fourth-hand information, which only serves to misinform the rest of the UFO community. The July craft actually crashed in the end of June and the recovery project went into July. Some people have tried to present the facts correctly, but they have been ridiculed and their information has not been believed. Because the Horse Mesa crash wasn't discovered until 1949, people think it was an entirely different craft. In reality, it was the exact same type as the Corona craft. In the movie, they showed sketches of the craft together, and it definitely appeared they crashed together. I believe the Ebon, extraterrestrial biological entity, that survived probably explained how it happened, but I was never briefed in exactly how he explained that the two crafts crashed. The crafts were approximately 35 feet by 42 feet. The vessel didn't have any actual levers or avionics that we would identify as a flight control system. Eventually, over time, they figured it all out. The creatures would put their hands on controls and they'd have this headset on, and this headset would somehow control or help them control the aircraft. They took the crafts to Wright-Patterson, where the top scientists could reverse engineer these crafts to figure out how they worked. In 1981, there was an Air Force scientist who passed away, and had left behind an old army footlocker full of autopsy photographs of the ETs that died in the Corona crash. We went out to recover his stuff and they appeared to be autopsy photos. The organs were out and I said, "This doesn't look like a heart, this doesn't look like a lung." What we found out was that these Ebbons had just one organ that was made up of a heart and lungs. It was just one organ. And they had a couple different stomachs for different digestive reasons. And they had an organ that would take every single bit of moisture out of whatever they ate and fed the body, so they didn't really have to drink a lot of fluids. On the bottom of each photograph was a case number and the date. And the dates were September of 1947, and the case wasn't a case number that I recognized. I eventually got a briefing by a scientist who was a medical doctor. He was from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, D.C. and gave us basically anatomy 101 of the extraterrestrial. And he confirmed these were the autopsy photographs from Corona. They had 11 different lobes of their brain. And where their spinal cord met the brain, it had two little bulbs on each side which they could never figure out what they were. The eyes were very sophisticated and the optic nerves went into different places in the brain from humans. As for reproductive organs, they were all male. I think the Ebon ones told them that there were females, but there weren't any females on any of these crafts. The males had a reproductive gland in the body, I guess it came out at the appropriate time. Their muscles were extremely fibrous, especially their leg muscles. They weren't bulky, but they were strong. They were fibered, which I guess gave them more strength than our muscles. They didn't have any ears, but they had a canal with an organ or gland, a little bulb out of which they could hear. But they didn't have vocal cords like we have. I read a briefing that was fascinating to me. It said that when this creature was found, he couldn't communicate other than hand signals. When he was taken to a medical facility at Los Alamos and examined, the physicians didn't know what they were examining. Eventually, we were able to communicate through sign language. Later, someone figured out how to do an operation on the vocal cord or insert something in there so it could talk, so it could make sounds. I found out years later they communicated telepathically. This Ebon that lived, he had an Air Force captain that was assigned to him and the captain was a linguist. He was also an intelligence officer and was able to build a really good rapport with the Ebon, communicating far more than anyone else could. He actually lived with this Ebon for 3 or 4 years until it died. I heard that this Ebon went to several different facilities. I know he went to Fort Detrick, Maryland, to Wright-Patterson, and he went to Huntsville Redstone Arsenal. Those are the only bases I actually know of. We did a field investigation of a scientist who died who had highly classified information of alien autopsies at his home. He had photographs, autopsy reports, detailed transcripts of the autopsies dictated from doctors who had performed them. This man was somewhat of a mystery but was originally an army internist. He should not have had those materials in an unsecured environment, but I saw them all. Testimonial. Philip S. Corso, Sr., U.S. Army Intelligence. Colonel Corso served on Eisenhower's National Security Council. He personally saw deceased extraterrestrials from the Roswell crash in 1947 and a UFO craft at an air base. While working in R&D, he was given fragments of extraterrestrial technologies from various crashes to seed industry with these technologies. I wasn't at Roswell in 1947. In 1947, I had just come back from Italy where I had been chief of security and intelligence in Rome. I was an ME-19. When I came back, I was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. One night I was first duty officer. First duty officer means that I was in control for that night and I checked all the guards, all security areas, I checked the whole post. So I went to the veterinarian section where I knew the sergeant of the guard. He informed me that 5 trucks were passing through from New Mexico en route to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and did I want to see it? I went back and there were 5 or 6 crates. I lifted one up and here's this body floating in fluid. First, I thought it was a child because it was so small. The head was different, the arms were thin, the body was gray, so right at that moment I figured I don't know what this thing is. I looked at it for about 10 to 15 seconds, not much more than that. I put the lid back down and said, "Sarge, get out of here now. I'm the duty officer and I can walk around here, but you might get in trouble for coming back here. The extraterrestrial, he's a little different. When this being enters our world, he is wearing a skin-tight suit. His skin is atomically aligned and his suit is atomically aligned. That is to repel radiation and harmful effects. Even cosmic radiation. Since he doesn't breathe air, the ones that come alive in this world will have a type of helmet on them. Since he doesn't speak, he has no vocal cords, he will have something that intensifies a transmission so he can communicate. The one craft I saw was at one of the air bases. The craft is really almost a biological type of structure because the extraterrestrial fits in it. 10 years later, I was down near Commando Range in New Mexico, in White Sands at the Army and Missile Firing Range, right near Trinity Site. I had pencil beam radar which locked on the target and the boys told me these objects were going about 3,000 to 4,000 miles an hour. Then, I was 4 years at the White House and I kept getting reports. I had all the clearances so I'd get them, even code reports I'd get. One time I did get a report that the NSA was getting signals from space, which were not just space noise, or unscrambled, or something you couldn't read. They were really very perfect and looked like something was guiding a real message. But we were never able to decode it. This was a very coordinated message. It wasn't space noise or mumbo jumbo or anything like that, or just noise coming in. It was a pattern. General Trudeau pulled me in. He had organized a research and development project. At first, when I reported in, I was a special assistant. Then he created the Foreign Technology Division about a week later and put me in charge of it. I started getting the autopsy reports of ETs from the laboratory at Walter Reed Hospital, and I started getting other crash reports and the artifacts from the crashes. We didn't leave any copies there. All copies had to come back to us because it was our lab. We financed it all. So we started getting proof that a crash really happened here. Of course, I kept it quiet for 35 years. I had an oath with General Trudeau and I didn't reveal names. Our deepest gratitude goes to James Fox for sharing this interview. Testimonial. Gordon Cooper, Mercury 7 astronaut and the last man to solo in space. These objects, UFOs, kept coming over, flying in the same kind of formation in which we flew our fighters while we were in Germany. They would come over and do the same maneuvers that we made, in our F-86s, except every once in a while, one of them would go zip, and make a maneuver that you can't do in a conventional fighter. We couldn't get to them. They flew higher and went faster. They weren't just random. They were flying fighter formations very definitely under control. They were saucer-shaped, double saucer-shaped, and metallic-looking. It didn't have wings on it or anything. It was pretty much the same shape as the ones we saw in Germany. Each one of them had a pilot in it. And were very definitely in communication with one another because they would make a turn or maneuver that had to be coordinated. While at Edwards Air Force Base, I was having some of the cameraman film precision landings. A saucer flew right over them, put down three landing gears, and landed out on the dry lake. They went out there with their cameras, towards the UFO. It lifted off, put the gear back in the well, and flew off at a very high rate of speed and disappeared. At the time this happened, I was involved in research and development and doing very classified projects at the task center. I knew that we didn't have any vehicles, like that. At that time. I am 99.9% sure that the Russians didn't have any of that type either. At that point in time, there was no doubt in my mind that the craft was made someplace other than here on Earth. Our deepest gratitude goes to James Fox for sharing this interview. Testimonial. AH is a person who has gained significant information from inside the UFO extraterrestrial groups within our government, military, and civilian companies. He has friends at the NSA, CIA, NASA, JPL, NRO, Area 51, the Air Force, Northrop, Boeing, and others. He once worked at Boeing as a surface technician. I worked at Boeing Aircraft Company at Long Beach, California as a surface technician for both the commercial side and military side of Boeing, formerly McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company. I was introduced to General Curtis Leem, a four-star general and chief of staff of the Air Force. I drove down to Newport Beach where he lived, we sat down and talked in his den. I asked him what percentage of all the UFO sightings remained unidentified. He replied that 35% of them could not be identified. When I asked him why not, he said, because the craft were too damn fast. We couldn't catch them. And then I asked him about the Roswell crash, if that really occurred. And he looked over at me and shook his head yes, that it did occur, and that it wasn't the military's. I was particularly interested in the strange writings that were found inside the craft and if they were ever deciphered, and he said no, they were not deciphered while he was in office. I can assure you that flying saucers, given that they exist, are not constructed by any power on Earth. President Harry S. Truman. April 4, 1950. White House Press Conference, UFO Secret File, The Truman Years 1945-1953. Testimonials, Philip Corso, Jr., son of Colonel Philip Corso, Sr., U.S. Army Intelligence Lieutenant Colonel Charles Brown, Project Grudge Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army Retrieval Unit Master Sergeant Dan Morris, NRO Operative, Cosmic Clearance, Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force and Contractor at Lockheed Skunk Works and the CIA, Graham Bethune, Navy Commander Pilot with a Top Secret Clearance. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. The downing and retrieval of ET spacecraft outside of Roswell was only the beginning. Between July of 1947 and December of 1952, the military's EMS, electromagnetic scalar, weapon brought down 13 extraterrestrial spacecraft, 11 of them in New Mexico and one each in Nevada and Arizona. Two other crashes occurred in Mexico and one in Norway. 65 bodies were recovered, including the one ET from the first crash that was kept alive for 3 years. It wasn't enough that Harry S. Truman had to manage the Cold War with the Soviets and the race between the two superpowers to complete testing on the hydrogen bomb, now the president also had flying saucers to contend with. He quickly assembled a group of people that included Dr. Vannevar Bush, who had headed up the atomic bomb program, as well as a number of leading scientists including Edward Teller and J. Robert Oppenheimer to study this issue. The first secret task force to investigate the ET phenomenon was organized under the name Project Sign and evolved into Project Grudge a year later. A low-level disinformation project named Blue Book was created to fool the public. Meanwhile, blue teams were trained to recover the downed ETVs, later evolving into alpha teams under Project Pounce. How did these extraterrestrial propulsion systems work? Were the weapons on board? In the wake of World War II and the burgeoning Cold War, there was a real concern about falling behind the Soviets. What if these new technologies were leaked out? To say we were facing a quantum leap in technological capability is an understatement, and of course, we wanted it for ourselves. National security demanded that this entire matter be kept quiet at all costs. No cost was spared in doing so. But there was one very large and busy fly in this ointment. The ETs were flying over the skies of America, sometimes in formation and before thousands of witnesses. How do you hide that? The answer is the mind hides it. In an Orwellian twist, it was found from past psychological warfare efforts that if you told a lie often enough and the lie is repeated by respected authority figures, the public will believe it.